This is Janet Dallet, When the Spirits Come Back, September 23rd, 1988, Tape 101.
It's with really great pleasure that I'm introducing Janet. Last time I saw Janet was about 8 years ago when I was attending a class of hers on dream analysis in Los Angeles. And it was a very fine class, and she's here with us now. We've both been through a lot over these past 8 years, at least judging from her book. I know she's been through a lot, and I know I have as well. Dr. Dallet is a graduate and a member of the Jung Institute in Los Angeles, where she taught for many years. And she was also the director of training there from 1976 to 1978. Her doctorate is in psychology, and it's from UCLA. In addition to her recent book, When the Spirits Come Back, she is the author of Midnight's Daughter, First Poems, published by the Lockhart Press. Her articles have appeared in psychology journals, as well as the Whole Earth Review, Free Spirit, and Voices. She lives, writes, and practices Jungian analysis in Port Townsend. It is with great pleasure that I introduce to you Dr. Janet Dallet.
It's very nice to see you all here tonight. If you can't hear me at any point, please make a lot of visual noise and I'll try to talk louder. Shaman, artist, lunatic, thief is a paper about creativity, but it is also a creative product. I'm going to approach my subject tonight from the inside out by telling you first about the process through which this particular piece of writing came into the world. Before 1980, I published a number of articles in psychological journals. They were written in the erudite, linear style that won me approval in the academic world, where I had spent interminable years of my life. In Jungian language, we could say that I was a good father's daughter, and that a patriarchal animus did my writing. Here's a sample of it. The paragraph I'm going to read you is from a paper called Theories of Dream Function, published in 1973. It will give you the flavor of what I was doing then. Quote, "The collective unconscious constitutes all those aspects of the psyche that are basic to the human condition, those psychological characteristics that belong to us by virtue of our biological structure. It is part of being human that most of us are born with two arms, two legs, a cerebral cortex, and the capacity to walk upright. These and all other aspects of our biology have certain psychological consequences and lead to typical modes of functioning and patterns of behavior that are reflected in the affects and images of the collective unconscious." You get the picture. "Then one day, from an unknown place in my psyche, something else rose up. Among other symptoms, I felt compelled to write poems. I was astonished, even alarmed, for I did not understand poetry. In fact, I rather disliked it. The material that burst from the unconscious at that time was passionate and irrational. It came in emotions and images instead of abstract logical ideas. Because the feminine center from which it came had been silent in me for many years, the new voice was primitive and undeveloped. Here's a poem for you to compare with the academic prose I just read you. This room stands bare, its polished floors, its open empty cupboards, stare down, silent air. Tree fire, making its way out of Hades, sneaks along winter bare branches to penetrate my outgrown house. She lives. Take, eat this woman's newborn bread. Drink her hot wine, body and blood, for you, for you. Gloria in excelsis. Bursting her skin, my friend the snake walks easy into spring. After 3 years of poetry, I went back to writing prose, but making poems had taught me to work in a new way. Instead of stringing ideas together in a logical sequence, I gradually developed a form more natural to my psyche, wherein material gathers as if in a circle around a central image. Now, when an idea for a piece of writing offers itself, I hold it in peripheral vision, so to speak, giving it energy, but not looking at it directly until later. This, in a manner of speaking, heats up the archetype behind the idea, and the activated archetype becomes like a magnet for related images, thoughts, events, and memories. I can't always see right away what connects a particular image to my theme, but if I trust the process and let the material guide me instead of imposing my ego logic upon it, the connections eventually become clear. The resulting prose sounds intensely personal, as it is, but it is also fed by an archetypal spring. Although it became the second chapter of my book, Shaman Artist Lunatic Thief was the first piece of prose I wrote in this way. It was stimulated by a flyer put out by Psychological Perspectives requesting papers for a special issue. The theme, women's mysteries and creativity, became the archetypal center for my paper. The flyer raised some questions about women's relation to art that I kept in the back of my mind, even though I did not address those questions directly. There were questions like, is it more natural for women to express themselves artistically than men? In a patriarchal culture, do the arts offer natural vehicles for women? Do women defend themselves by remaining silent artistically? What language do women speak? I also thought about some things Jung says about creative people in his paper Psychology and Literature. For instance, quote, "It makes no difference whether the artist knows that his work is generated, grows, and matures within him, or whether he imagines that it is his own invention. In reality, it grows out of him, as a child, its mother. The creative process has a feminine quality, and the creative work arises from unconscious steps. We might say from the realm of the mothers. Whenever the creative force predominates, life is ruled and shaped by the unconscious rather than by the conscious will, and the ego is swept along on an underground current. The progress of the work becomes the poet's fate and determines his psychology. It is not Goethe that creates Faust, but Faust that creates Goethe." End quote. I held these things in the back of my mind for more than a year, jotting down ideas that came to me and putting these fragmentary notes into a file folder. Late one night, after I had drunk far too much wine, the first sentence of the paper dropped whole into my mind. I wrote it down, somewhat incoherently, and left it on my desk. When I reread it the next morning, it startled me, but I soon saw that it contained the seeds of things that I did not know I knew. Then I got out the file folder and began to write the paper. When I submitted the finished piece to Psychological Perspectives, some of the things I said about Jung and the Jungian subculture disturbed members of the editorial board. One person said, quote, "Dalit is caught in a negative father projection onto Jung." "One I feel would be embarrassing to print." End quote. Another commented, quote, "Unfortunately, the article is marred seriously by a number of categorical statements about Jung's shadow and his relation to the anima that are not backed by evidence." End quote. I felt misunderstood. But I agreed to remove those parts from the published paper because they made my colleagues angry. I do feel that this disagreement proves one of the paper's main points, that creativity cannot help but threaten the established order. To enliven tonight's discussion, I have restored the expurgated sections. During the second half of the evening, I will be interested to hear your reactions to these and other parts of the material and to answer your questions. So without further ado, here is Shaman, Artist, Lunatic, Thief. My father, a closet homosexual, abandoned both his sexuality and his creativity in 1919 when he came home from the war, married my mother, and never returned to Ann Arbor and the architectural career for which he had been destined. I suppose I should be grateful for the opportunity to be born, but it has been a mixed blessing. I was thrust into the world during a blizzard on the day the banks closed, at the nadir of the Great Depression. And ever after, it was implied that I might have had the grace to remain behind in my mother's midlife womb, making it possible for my father to become the equal of Frank Lloyd Wright. Instead, he despaired his life away at a small factory job to support the children, of whom I was third and last. Like all parents who beg the question of their own destiny and sacrifice too much for the sake of the children, my father passed his problems along to me unchanged. His life did not transform the dilemma of creativity one iota. Had he been able to relate to the woman within him, she might have redeemed him. But my father was a man of his time and felt he had no choice but to suppress her. Given no other voice, she became a petty tyrant of whose domination he was as much victim as we. Every morning at breakfast, my father silently wept. No one ever asked him what was the matter. No one dared. By then, she had terrorized us all. I was 4 years old the time my mother talked back to my father and refused to cook his dinner. He announced that the judge who lived next door would order her to cook the meal to which his conjugal rights entitled him. Really happened. Well, he went to see the judge. My mother took me downtown and spent 10 cents on a double-dip lemon custard ice cream cone. I still remember. It was still depression time, and dimes were scarce. I felt so guilty about having all that money and attention lavished on me that I tripped and spilled the ice cream right outside the store. When we got home, my father had calmed down. The judge refused to force my mother to cook, but the damage was done. The ice cream was spilled, and as bound by the era as my father, my mother never talked back again. Close to the time of her death, my mother told me she had once been offered a scholarship to college. Aghast, she had refused, unable to conceive that she might have intellectual and creative gifts of her own. Woman's place was in the kitchen, and there she stayed, after her one brave attempt to defect. Times have changed, but not as much as it might seem. A friend who was a successful writer showed some of her work to her husband when they were first married, and he dismissed it as meaningless drivel. She dutifully forgot about writing and gave her complete attention to the care and feeding of her husband, carrying his image of her as a good wife should. Only after they were divorced did she pick up her writing again and see how good it is. Only then did she take herself seriously enough as a writer to give it the energy and attention that have led to her success. By the same token, Sally was once an outstanding weaver. When she married Ralph, a painter, he explained to her that weaving is not art and urged her to take up painting. She complied. She considers Ralph's work to be better than her own, and when he comes to her studio, he often picks up a brush and corrects her images. She is grateful for his help, having learned from her father, who is an art expert, to defer to masculine authority in this matter as in others. When she developed cancer, Sally returned to weaving, where her energy flows naturally and lovingly into the work. But self-doubt haunts her still. As a weaver, she violates Ralph's image of her and refuses to carry the woman within him on her back. If she doesn't do it, maybe another woman will. Perhaps the role she has played in relation to Ralph is her life, her fulfillment as a woman. For centuries, women have existed to carry the psyches of men, just as the function of horses has been to carry people on their backs. Until quite recently, men and women alike have accepted that this is the natural order of things, unaware that it prevents them both from becoming whole. Seen in historical perspective, the notion that a woman might be someone in her own right with a fully separate identity is revolutionary. The idea that a man has a feminine side that could develop into something different from the woman with whom he lives is equally fantastic. With rare exceptions, the drive for men and women to become fully functioning human beings, distinct from one another, is brand new. Never having been here before, we have all too few role models or precedents for such a development. No wonder it is so hard. After so many centuries of being horses, no wonder it is so desperately difficult for women to decline to be only what their men imagine them to be. No wonder the inner pressure to become individuals emerges so explosively in women. No wonder it is so hard for all of us, men and women, in this time when the creative psyche has begun to make its claim. In a lecture given in London in the 1930s, for which the manuscript appears to be lost, Jung is said to have predicted a great outpouring of creativity at the turn of the century, as an old eon comes to an end and we move into the new millennium. Now, in the 1980s, a massive wave of creative energy is clearly visible. At the same time, we are meeting the archetypal feminine, the resurgent great goddess in her many forms. It is no coincidence that creativity and the feminine come forth together. This culture's collective consciousness, composed of the myriad assumptions that dominate our values, perceptions, and choices, is fundamentally patriarchal. The collective unconscious of a patriarchal society, the source of its big dreams, carries the values excluded from consciousness and therefore has a feminine or matriarchal bias. I want to make it clear that the words patriarchal and matriarchal do not mean men and women or even male and female. Both men and women in a patriarchal culture are unconsciously dominated by patriarchal attitudes unless they become conscious individuals. Likewise, patriarchal attitudes constitute only one set of the forms that masculinity can take. Creative individuals today are compelled to abandon patriarchal ground and descend to the murky realm of the mothers to bring forth what presses to be born into the consciousness of a new age. To journey into another reality is always perilous. A man may particularly fear the creative process because in entering matriarchal space, he feels his masculinity to be at risk. Beginning an intense period of painting, John dreamed that he was drawn irresistibly into the house of an unknown woman, thence directly to the room where she kept her sewing machine. On the machine was a spool of red thread. John went straight to it, feeling that he must have a piece of the thread, but afraid that the woman who owned the house would catch him there. How would he explain his presence? He pulled out a length of the thread and tried to break it off. The woman came closer and closer. The thread was too strong to break. John awoke in fear, looking for something with which to cut the thread, unable to leave it behind, but terrified that the woman would catch him. I have seen the image of the red thread in several artists' dreams and believe it symbolizes the vital emotional connection to the feminine without which truly creative work is impossible. This dream reveals a creative man's risk of not being able to cut the cord and the danger that he will be trapped in the matriarchal unconscious if he enters it and tries to get a piece of the red thread. Because John had a severe psychotic episode several years ago, he is especially sensitive to the possibility that he might not be able to return from the psyche's depths. The psychology of a creative woman is somewhat different, for the realm of the mothers is her most fundamental reality. To fulfill her creative destiny, a woman must become grounded in the divinity in whose image she was made, goddess, not God. When she succeeds, she no longer asks the men in her life to be gods. Then they cease to have the power to subvert her creative life, but are freed to live their own if they can overcome their fear. Even though her feminine identity is not at risk, a woman makes some of the same sacrifices as a man does to be creative. Both must submit to the direction of the collective unconscious, which usually means giving up the wish for power and prestige in a patriarchal culture. Jean, an accomplished writer with an intense need to communicate her inner experiences, consulted me because of a severe writing block. Soon she dreamed, "My mother has written some poetry. I read it, and it is really good. It has my idiom, my style, but it is better than I can do. It makes me very jealous and unhappy." End of dream. Jean's outer world mother is not a writer. The dream suggests that her writing block might result from her wish to write from consciousness rather than putting her ability into the service of the images that want to emerge from the unconscious. That would be expressed by the image her mother's writing. After we discussed that possibility, the character of her dreams changed completely, emerging as extraordinary examples of the unconscious psyche's writing ability. Here is the first of many such dreams. I was backpacking with a man friend in the High Sierra. We were sitting in a meadow next to a stream. The stream flowed into a small lake, and tall, jagged peaks rose above. The meadow was full of flowers, butterflies, birds, and small animals. The sunshine had a special, brilliant clarity about it. Suddenly, a strong wind came up. The sky clouded over. The temperature dropped, and it started to rain. The water felt like it was going through us. We found a cave and crawled in. The roof was too low to sit up, so we lay down and went to sleep. Next, it was dawn and my friend was gone. I looked out through the narrow cave opening. Instead of the bright meadow, the world outside was barren and desolate. The meadow had shriveled, the stream dried, the lake stagnated. Earth and sky were gray. The sun was rising, brilliant, but somehow stark. A tarantula crawled onto my knee and sat watching me. I stroked her fur. She went over to the cave opening and started to spin a web across it. I was mesmerized by the spinning. First, I thought the web was unusually rich and beautiful. Then, as I looked more closely, I realized that it was a microcosm. There were mountains, trees, rocks, birds, flowers, all making up the filaments. Then I saw that as the web grew, pieces of the world outside the cave would disappear, reappearing again in the web. The world in the web began to look as the meadow had the day before, sparkling, abounding with life, but in miniature. Then I felt myself being entwined in the web, and I was sitting by the stream in the meadow again. End of dream. Thus can the collective unconscious speak under some circumstances, using a person's writing ability to record the inner images and events. It is as if Jean has been chosen in the religious sense to bring forth contents that her mother, the goddess, wants to make more widely known. What she thinks she wants to write is beside the point. As we move toward the close of this century, the goddess, the mother world, the creative psyche, exerts enormous pressure. Increasing numbers of people find themselves in Jean's position. Because our culture has buried essential aspects of the human spirit, pushing them to the center of the earth, where they have slowly grown to white heat, they now burst forth with volcanic power. The eruption is natural and inevitable, its effects on human life both positive and negative. It brings renewed spirituality and extraordinary creativity, hand in hand with psychosis, life-threatening illness, burnout, and the breakdown of social forms. Many who feel the impact of this influx from the collective unconscious are artists. Others are not, but are distinguished by what I have come to think of as the psychology of the creative person, who has an overriding need to give birth to the images and ideas that arise within. Expression is therapeutic for such people, and if they do not express, they may become ill, physically, emotionally, or both. For this kind of person, the unexpressed images are like poison in the system. Creative people often find themselves crucified on a conflict between the requirements of everyday outer reality and the inner life that screams to come out, will come out in one way or another. Classically, this has been the artist's conflict, frequently expressed as a fear that he will prostitute himself if he creates to sell rather than from the purity of his vision. The same conflict dominates the creative person who is not an artist. It stems from the fact, known deep in the psyche but usually unconscious, that creative vision almost always conflicts with existing cultural values. Creativity brings forth images of new gods that challenge or destroy the old, while established consciousness necessarily holds to the old gods. A young man's parents once sent him to me with the complaint that he periodically went crazy and tried to smash everything in sight. Furniture, windows, dishes, whatever was at hand. Sometimes he even pissed on the floor. He had been given pills to calm him down, large doses of good advice about shaping up and living right, but he still smashed things. Although he had no conscious wish to be destructive, he felt powerless to change the pattern. I discovered that he liked to paint and urged him to do more of it. His untrained work was sensitive and expressive. So long as he kept at it, the compulsion to smash things abated. But whenever he stopped painting for any length of time, the urge to destroy overtook him. It was as if when he failed to paint, the goddess possessed him in her black aspect. She would be served, and if not through creation, then through the destruction that is her other side. The dark face of the goddess is visible in the psyche at this time in many ways, in widespread personal upheaval, and particularly in the loss of orientation between men and women. Her anger reasserts the values of the earth, the primitive and the instinctive. She reacts in anguish against the lopsided development of a technology whose irreverence and disrespect for nature has gone too far. In Cancer, almost epidemic just now, she declares herself in a way that cannot be ignored. The uncontrollable assertion of cell growth gone mad gives terrifying concreteness to her insistence that she must have some attention before the values of the feminine are lost forever, and with them, the earth. Some forms of cancer appear to result from an inability to balance an intense creative drive with the requirements of everyday life. That is, from a failure to resolve the creative conflict. This conflict is particularly poignant in women because the personal, particularly in relationship, is central to the spirit of woman. I have never forgotten a cartoon I saw in the New Yorker many years ago. One woman talking to another says something like, "I make the little decisions, like where we live and what we eat and where the kids go to school. My husband decides the important things, like who should be president and what to do about the war in Vietnam." The truth behind this kind of humor may explain why women's art often wants to be more personal and subjective than is compatible with patriarchal forms. Three women with whom I work analytically have all dreamed the same archetypal image. All three are gifted artists. One has cancer, and one has had several psychotic episodes. All suffer deeply from the creative conflict, an excruciating tension between the demands of financial survival, husband and children on the one hand, and an intense need to paint, write, or sculpt on the other. All three dreamed that the moon is moving closer to the earth, requiring the dreamer to make a major personal effort to prevent moon and earth from colliding. The moon symbolizes the feminine archetype, the goddess, that exerts a powerful force upon the earth at this time. This dream's recurrence among creative women shows what an extraordinary effort such women must now make to prevent their lives from being destroyed. It is as if the goddess is angry with how we are living and refuses to go on being cut off from life and overlooked as she has been through the Judeo-Christian era. She demonstrates that she has the power to destroy individual lives and even the earth itself. If we fail to pay attention, we will be moonstruck, that is, lunatics. Lunacy and creativity are two sides of the same coin. Breakdown of body or psyche is the first phase of a creative process which, like the paradoxical genius of nature itself, aims toward wholeness, a moon-like condition in which light and dark are of equal value and import. Whenever the individual or the society with which she identifies becomes too one-sided, too separated from the depth and truth of human experience, something in the psyche rises up and moves to restore authenticity. Breakdown momentarily sets life free from the demands of ordinary reality and activates a profoundly spiritual process, an inner rite of passage with its own healing end. If its creative purpose aborts, when we fail to understand the symbolic language it speaks, the process is not at fault. Whether or not such a process achieves its goal or remains stuck in insanity depends in part upon the individual's willingness and capacity to work with its images and express them creatively. Jung pointed out, for example, that a crucial difference between James Joyce and his schizophrenic daughter Lucia was that Joyce worked on the material of the unconscious and developed it in his writing, while Lucia merely drowned in it. Because of my parents' example and the requirements of their time, which emphasized material gain at the cost of creative expression, I personally remained dangerously oblivious to the creative pressures within me until my early 20s. Then, during a period of profound emotional distress, I entered Jungian analysis. As soon as I began to explore my dreams, I became overwhelmed by unconscious material. Although I continued to function in a part-time job, I spent long hours lying on the bed in the tiny attic apartment where I lived, swept by images and emotions I did not understand. After a few months, some instinct told me to try to give form to the deluge, and I began to paint. I showed this work to no one, not even my analyst, for it did not occur to me that anyone would be interested. Over a period of 16 years, I filled a large portfolio with paintings. I had no training, nor was I inclined to get any, for I did not think of my work as art. In fact, it most certainly is not, if the standards of those who make fashions in art are applied to it. Reflecting upon it now, however, I see it has the mark of art's origins, wherein men and women found themselves compelled to make images of what moved them and moved within them, driven by an impulse akin to the religious. I brought you a sample to look at. These four paintings are pieces of that material. Is such work then religion? I would say it's religion only in the original sense of the word, whose probable root meaning to bind back hints at a bond between human beings and something greater, something that is activated whenever self-reflection begins and deep levels of the psyche stir. Still, my own painting is no more acceptable to the standards of religion as it is practiced in the churches than to the temples of art. There is a third thing that these paintings are, neither art nor religion, but related to both. They are healers. They embody an ongoing process of psychological healing and development that is mine, yet does not belong to me. Weighted as it is with archetypal content, such a process reaches into the pain of the very earth and touches the profound wounds that contemporary humankind have in common. When I completed my training and was certified as a Jungian analyst, I stopped painting. I was not aware of any reason for stopping. I just stopped. It was only much later that I understood what was happening well enough to overcome this mysterious resistance that came up toward my creative life. At the time, I was not aware that my training as a Jungian analyst made me a card-carrying member of a patriarchal institution like any other. In becoming an analyst, I joined the group and immediately fell into contradiction with myself as an artist. Certainly, I did not know that my creative daemon, if permitted to live, would be compelled to move in opposition to the system simply because it is creative, and the images it generates challenge established gods. I just quietly stopped painting and quickly forgot the vital connection between creativity and my own healing process. The conscious values of my profession supported creative expression for Jungian patients. But something in the unconscious did not want a Jungian analyst to take herself seriously as an artist. When I started to write poetry and to read it in public, I soon felt that I was violating an unspoken taboo. But it took me a long time to see what might be behind it. Jung was an accomplished painter. In his autobiography, he writes about an encounter early in his career with an inner voice that said he was an artist. Jung made it clear right away to the woman within him that he was no artist. In fact, he felt that he would have been seduced away from the important work of his life if he had believed her. This was undoubtedly right for Jung. However, what was right for Jung is not necessarily right for all Jungians. I have written elsewhere about the disconcerting power that Jung's image and life have upon the psyches of those who follow in his footsteps. If it is properly understood, this archetypal effect can activate the individuation process. When it is not understood, it obscures the individual path and makes us into mere imitators of Jung, instead of the whole human beings we were born to become. Contemporary Jungian analysts, as well as many of our patients, suffer and wrestle with pieces of Jung's personal unconscious. So long as it remains unanalyzed, this material constitutes a kind of collective Jungian unconsciousness. The best known instances of Jung's personal shadow are his naivete in not speaking out publicly, decisively, and early against the Nazis, and his unconventional and possibly exploitative sexual behavior in relation to two women patients, Toni Wolff and Sabina Spielrein. Personally, I see these events as the result of ordinary human failings. As an introverted thinking type, Jung's fascination with understanding the unconscious sometimes prevailed over extroversion and feeling considerations. Because I am myself an introverted thinking type, I understand those aspects of Jung's shadow all too well. However, when large numbers of followers imitate the personal failings and idiosyncrasies of a great man, what was small and ordinary becomes amplified to archetypal proportions that obliterate our humanity. The unthinking imitation of Jung's reaction to the woman artist voice can have similarly far-reaching effects. In my psyche, and I believe in others, it promotes a taboo against analysts making art that can deaden the profession at best, and at worst, slow or stop the personal development of the analyst whose fate it is to be creative. Behind the Jungian taboo, of course, lies another, deeply embedded in the Judeo-Christian tradition. The second of the Ten Commandments clearly prohibits making pictures from what emerges from the depths. Quote, "Thou shalt not make unto thee any graven image, or any likeness of anything that is in heaven above, or that is in the earth beneath, or that is in the water under the earth." End quote. In his novel, My Name is Asher Lev, Chaim Potok writes the story of a Hasid's son who is destined to become an artist. Beginning in childhood, the boy Asher is compelled from within to draw pictures, to create the images whose very existence violate his father's traditional religious sensibilities. His mother supports him in his innermost need, but to his father, the boy remains incomprehensible and therefore a threat. The book begins, quote, "My name is Asher Lev, the Asher Lev, about whom you have read in newspapers and magazines, about whom you talk so much at your dinner parties, your dinner affairs and cocktail parties, the notorious and legendary Lev of the Brooklyn crucifixion. I am an observant Jew." Yes, of course, observant Jews do not paint crucifixions. As a matter of fact, observant Jews do not paint at all in the way that I am painting. So strong words are being written and spoken about me. Myths are being generated. I am a traitor, an apostate, a self-hater, an inflictor of shame upon my family, my friends, my people. Also, I am a mocker of ideas sacred to Christians, a blasphemous manipulator of modes and forms revered by Gentiles for 2,000 years. Well, I am none of those things, and yet, in all honesty, I confess that my accusers are not altogether wrong. I am indeed, in some way, all of those things." End quote. These sentences capture the essential features of the creative conflict. Crucified, caught between the father world and the mother world, Asher has painted his fate. He is hated by those who believe in the dominant conscious values, that is, the father's, because the images that come to him from the collective unconscious, that is, the mother's, mock the old gods, but he cannot do otherwise because his creative nature compels him to bring images of new gods into the world. He is none of the things of which he is accused, yet on some level he is all of them. That is, he is a personal human being, but he is also the carrier of an archetypal fate that interferes dramatically with his personal happiness. One day last year, I lingered over lunch in the Trillium Cafe in Seal Harbor, the small town where I live. The atmosphere was extraordinarily animated. Tuning into conversations at the tables around me, I became aware that everyone in the room was talking about dreams. I was thrilled. A selection of my paintings hung on the walls, together with a written description of how they came into being. Entitled Painting as Healer, the show was having a strong and unexpected impact. A few months earlier, I had shown my paintings to a patient hoping to help her open to the creative spirit. I imagined that if she saw how primitive my work is, it might free her to trust her own dimly formed creative impulses and follow them into life, instead of worrying about whether or not she was making art. As she looked through my portfolio, she became electrified. She said, "Haven't you ever wanted to show these?" I told her it had not occurred to me. She begged me to let her put together a show of the work. Although I agreed, I trembled with a feeling of taboo. I arranged to be out of town when the show was hung. When I entered the cafe later that month, I sneaked in like a thief, looking furtively about to be sure no one I knew was there. Now, seeing what I can only describe as an inductive effect of the work on other psyches, I became aware that it made an opening into another world for people from all walks of life, people who would not ordinarily be motivated to notice their dreams or to give conscious attention to the spirit world in any way. As I sat in the cafe that day, I fell deep into déjà vu. A few years earlier, when I began reading my poetry in public, many people had seemed puzzled by the work, and some had expressed strong feelings of discomfort with it, just as some did now with my paintings. Simultaneously, then as now, others had reported that their creativity was stimulated by mine. Reflecting upon these events, I understood for the first time that a certain kind of work, resembling what Jung calls visionary art, functions in much the same way as the shaman in tribal societies. That is, some art is shamanic in function. Formed from collective unconscious material, it activates the unconscious of its audience and mobilizes the psyche's self-healing capacities. It opens a door to a different reality, the world of dreams and imagination, and something like spirits silently pass into the world of every day, affecting people in unexpected ways. Shamanic art undermines unexamined cultural assumptions. For this reason, it disturbs some people and may even arouse rage. Those who are open to it, however, often find that it sets their own creativity in motion. Such art tends to be prophetic. It asks, even insists on being heard, just as the shaman is compelled to tell about her inner experiences when she begins to apply what she has learned about healing herself to the healing of others. The visionary creative act is not complete until it finds an audience, coming out into the world and disturbing the complacent surface of collective consciousness. If the process is blocked, one outcome may be psychosis. Cancer may be another. Shamanic art brings Eros values to the healing of the psyche. That is, unlike traditional clinical psychology and psychiatry, it is more concerned with connecting and making whole than with the logos values of dissecting and understanding. It is related to a form of psychotherapy that interprets rarely, seeking instead to set in motion a symbolic process that has its own unforeseeable healing goal. Understanding of behavior is important only to the extent that it serves a living relationship to deep levels of the psyche. Since it is fundamentally creative, this approach to psychotherapy sacrifices the claim to clarity, undermines unexamined assumptions, and is more disturbing to than supportive of conformity. The archetype of shaman lies equally behind the visionary artist and the therapist who works in this way. If the shamanic type of therapist ceases to live her own creative life, the capacity to function in healing ways becomes lost and may even turn destructive. Jung would have been the first to admit that his great genius did not spare him limitation. In some respects, he was as embedded in the patriarchal bias of his place and time as my father was. If Jung had been born 50 years later, and certainly if he had been a woman, I imagine he would have reacted differently to the inner voice of a woman who told him he was an artist. He might have followed the subterranean red thread that runs through his own writing, leading to a therapeutic model that unites artist and analyst in an approach to healing closer to shaman than clinician. Had I not been influenced so unconsciously by Jung's response to the artist within him, I imagine I would not have stopped painting when I became an analyst. I might even have seen clearly that for some of us, The capacity to activate the healing power of the psyche cannot be separated from our creativity. As I inherited the problem of unlived creativity from my father, Jungians may take on this conflict from Jung, and others absorb it from the peculiarly rigid character of contemporary life. A major, perhaps the major, psychological task of our time is to rescue the creative life of the spirit from destruction by the ossified patriarchal values and lifeless materialism that characterize a large segment of the world today. I believe that the planet's survival may depend on the number of people who are able to engage this task. Speaking as a woman, however, my most compelling reason not to shirk the full burden of my own creative life is personal. To the extent that I fail to come to terms with its difficulties, I will simply pass them on, unaltered, to my son, Nick. Not long after I began to address the problem of creativity in a serious way, Nick dreamed that I had written a letter, as yet unanswered, to a prestigious author. In his dream, Nick and I find ourselves together near the place where the author lives, an apartment that is made to look empty and deserted, its doorway blocked by a huge seashell. With the help of a friend, Nick finds out how to gain entry. The author responds by inviting me to come in, but in Nick's words, quote, "My mom is scared to go in, and she sends me in instead." The author sits in a wicker chair. I, that is Nick, sit opposite him. The room is dark. He holds Mom's letter in his hand and starts to respond as if I had written it. I'm waiting apprehensively for him to ask me a question about it. I'm trying to remember everything he says so I can relay it back to Mom. I know there are questions she wants answered, but I don't know what she would ask. End of dream. The dream speaks for itself. If I am not to burden Nick with the tasks in life that are mine, as my father burdened me when he sacrificed his creative life for my sake, I must overcome my fear and discover what the author in me wants to say. Why has he been locked away in a dark and empty place? I must find a way to let him out and ask him my questions directly. Now let's take a break. I'm at your service to answer questions or listen to criticisms or give you therapy or whatever you want to do with this one. Yes. People ask me where the title of the piece came from, and of course it comes from the old childhood rhyme, but I realized in time that it's quite meaningful anyway. It seems to me that shaman, artist, lunatic, and thief are alternative modes of dealing with a similar psychological condition. And the existence of these particular alternatives makes the ethical condition of the person of supreme importance. I guess that's all I have to say about that right now. Well, that's the really scary time, because you don't have any, there are no road signs, there are no guideposts. And that's the time when you have to turn inside and start listening to what comes up in the time, and taking seriously the little impulses, little things, usually not something big. You know, people say at that point, well, now what am I going to do? How am I going to spend the rest of my life? And it's usually not that big. It's usually just a question of moment to moment listening and paying attention to what's coming up from inside. And pretty soon you know the bigger stuff from listening to the little stuff. Is that?
Yeah.
Well, very often it involves major changes, actually. Ultimately, it moves toward major changes in people's lives. Ultimately. But you can't know that until you start listening to the little stuff. I know the motif that you're talking about reminds me of a motif that came up in my dreams maybe 20 years ago, in which I started out on the freeway in my dreams, and the roads got smaller and smaller and narrower and narrower, and pretty soon there were cow paths, and then pretty soon there was no path at all. And this would happen in the dreams. I'd be going along on the freeway, and all of a sudden, you know, the roads would start narrowing again. So that the possibility of just going along the collective route absolutely got taken away inch by inch. And that's what's happening. It's like you can't go the collective way anymore. And that means you have to become an individual and start paying for yourself and feeling for yourself. And that's scary. Yes.
That's beautiful. Yeah. That's beautiful. That's beautiful. Yeah. The larger has been. Yeah. Yeah, that's very good. Well, I think what she's saying is that following that, what you're calling a compulsion, is prayer. And that what happens when you do that is prayer. Uh-huh. Yeah. That's how it goes, isn't it? It isn't what we expect.
Yeah. I found myself reacting to the term patriarchal as if it were something very negative. You know, like this big, god awful patriarchal system. And then I thought, well, you know, is it really that horrible? It must be some good to it. It's that bad. It's working in our society. What's the flip side of that?
It's it's not a dirty word. I think.
I know.
It does tend to sound that way. I think the problem is that we're at a time culturally when the way things have been it's breaking down, and the patriarchal way has become too rigid. So that it tends to come up in a negative form fairly often, sort of in the form, in thou shalt not kind of form, in restrictive and negating form. But that certainly isn't inherent to patriarchal. I think it's inherent to patriarchal in our time, that something more fluid has been happening now. So the psyche, things are coming up in the psyche that pushes us to one another.
What are the positive aspects
of
would that
lead
to something
quick? Dear. Well, because I mean, it has to be available in the developing consciousness and the environment.
Yeah. Yeah, a lot of good stuff.
Which could be very creative, huh? Can be, but
that's only if it doesn't become rigid and exclusive and not let anything else in. And in many cases, it has tended to become that way in contemporary life. It didn't start out that way. That's right. Go ahead. I would say that both patriarchy and matriarchy are essentially unconscious. To be caught by collective consciousness is not individually conscious. So that from that point of view, both patriarchy and matriarchy are unconscious modes of functioning. We just sort of go along and we either do it the collective way, which makes it patriarchal, or we something rises up and
Yeah.
There is a an apparently unsuppressible accusation that comes up at periodic intervals, accusing you of having been sympathetic to Anderson. This is not true, as far as I've been able to find out. But he identified with this position as a Swiss, and therefore maintained a strict neutrality in the statements he made about the Nazi regime for a long period of time. And in retrospect, I personally feel that that was a mistake. It's the kind of a mistake I also in the past would made out of my introversion and also in the wanting to be objective. Thinking about people are always wanting to be objective. They don't have these strong feeling responses about that's really right and that's really wrong. That's why I say that I think it was out of his introverted thinking that Jung did not stand up right away and say, listen, what's going on there is really terrible. I don't think so. I think he just didn't fully realize the enormity of remaining silent. Not for a scientist who is fully creative. No, I don't see it coming. I think Einstein was as creative as Rambo. I think this person is better than that. Well, the breakdown that I wrote about happened in, I think it was 84, and if she's going to have another one, it's due next year. So I still can't tell you that. No, there was somebody. No, I wouldn't say that Jung suppressed his own creativity. He stepped rather hard on the anima voice that came up and said, you're an artist. Do you want to go on and formulate what? No, Jung was an incredibly creative person. I certainly wouldn't want to say that Jung should have expressed more creativity than he did. I don't imagine that would be possible. But there was a pattern in terms of how he thought about himself that has gotten passed on to those of us who follow in his footsteps, and we sometimes misapply it to ourselves. And that does stifle our creativity if we misapply what he did to us. Yeah, he really squashed that voice when she came up. Have you read Memories, Dreams, Reflections? You'll know what I mean if you read that. You'll come to that part and you'll recognize it, where he has this conversation. He treats her rather shabbily, actually, at that point in time. Let's see, I've been facing in this direction. I'll just pull over here. Yeah.
I think about that really moves me as a wrestler, but measurably, but marked by the idea of the animals at the core being the animal. And so I said, well, what would then the animal be then? And it's a part of the black film.
Well, what I'm doing right now is my effort not to do that. In other words, writing the book I just published and talking. Up till that point, I had really not fully taken up my creative life. I thought I had, but I really hadn't. And when Nick had that dream, he was probably 21 or so when he had it. It made me realize that was the stimulus that made me realize, well, yeah, you know, you really haven't done it yet. You better get ready to take it out. I don't think we can prevent these things ever. We can't be perfect parents. But when we become aware that our children are carrying a piece of our unlived life, then we can begin to try to take that out. It takes a little piece off the back of our kids. Well, I think we become sort of dead. We simply stop growing and developing and stop living the things that we need to be living, and then our children take these tasks up, and we're satisfied to let that happen. It unfortunately does not make parents uncomfortable, it makes parents comfortable. And we have to be uncomfortable in order to see that. When Nick had that dream, it made me very uncomfortable. I was being quite comfortable with the state of affairs until he had that dream, and then I got very uneasy and started feeling guilty about what I wasn't doing, but I never would have. I would have just let him go ahead and live that out if something hadn't brought it to my attention. I don't think that usually happens. It's an interesting question. Have you? Nothing. Okay. Robert Johnson. Do you know anything about your typology? Have you? Is that something you've thought about? Jung said that people who get hit by feelings in the way that you do, it's really important for somebody like you to find some creative way of giving those things form and putting them out so that other people can respond to them. And it may be difficult to find the right form. It's probably not words because, you know, you say you just don't know how to verbalize them. But maybe you could play around with other creative media to give some form to the things that you're feeling so that that can then become a communication and the stuff doesn't just have to all stay bottled up inside. Well, it might be really important for you, like, to paint or sculpt, or find some other way of expressing them besides just directly. Something to think about. I should say my son also continues to be very creative. I think we just get an overload. It's kind of overloaded for us if our parents have squashed it.
Yeah.
spirit to never quite let it together with them, and not only in the face of the prospect that they were inside that one.
They do that, don't they? Yeah, that's right. Actually, not until about 5 years ago. And when I started writing, I pretty much stopped painting again, but I don't think that's a suppression of the painting. I think it's an alternative mode that my creative juices are still operating almost full time there.
So you don't perceive that it's therapy?
No, I think it's a... I personally think it's a mistake to see that as the only creative mode if you're a very creative person. I think it overloads the therapy relationship. Big question? No, that. Yeah, there are other kinds of love. I don't want anybody to leave this room thinking that I said that in general Jung squashed the animal. That isn't true. There was just this incident that in Jungian circles gets sort of amplified. There was this early incident. But what I believe the source of what Jung called visionary creativity is the collective unconscious, which in our culture has a matriarchal model. Simply say that you have to go into your unconscious in order to become creative in the way that you thought. There are other forms of that. It's different for each person. It's a very individual way. Have to look at the images that come up in your dream and say, well, what are these women like? And that will tell you something.
Yeah.
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 Yeah. One more question.
if they are totally conscious, but these usually are usually unconscious. I would imagine I am still living some of my father's only creative life. Total individuality is very hard to understand. I don't know if any of us ever really. Nobody loses it. If it's just there. But if the first generation squashes it, then it may get overloaded in the second generation. If the first generation lives it, the second generation can also live it. If the first generation lives it, there aren't any constraints. In a limited way, yeah. Did you say one at a time, or? Yeah.
Sure. Let's see.
This
I painted while I was going through a lot of particular things, and also I was in the process of writing a poem. On the back of this, I have written a piece of the poem which says, "Gray wind chills her bones 1 degree at a time. Animals watching her 2 sides fill her with cat power." Now, that doesn't affect people. Now, what was happening at the time that I did this painting? For those of you who've read the book, I think it's the third chapter is called Telling the Truth. And for those of you who haven't read it, I was going through a period in which I was having trouble getting out of bed, almost literally. And I was spending a period of time virtually incubating, and it was very much a healing time for me. And this painting was what I thought of as a painting to help me be conscious of protection and incubation and not letting these. These things could be seen as bullets or eyes, either one trying to penetrate my protective sense. And the the cats and this thing around me are intended to protect me and to protect the process that's growing inside me until it has a chance to mature and until I can come out of the cocoon in a way that isn't going to destroy the thing that's growing inside. So to the extent that I understand that painting, that's what I intended to be doing. Well, I did that painting in 1964 at a time when I did not have the... This is a penis on one end and it's a knife on the other end, which is another expression of the masculine archetype. And I needed a contact with that, and I needed to integrate some of the positive aspects of the masculine talent. And if you look closely at it, you can see that there is a woman. Dancing in primitive worship of that masculine figure. Mm-hmm. Right. Which is I want to make it very clear that from my point of view, the patriarchy and the masculine are not identical. That there are many, many forms that the masculine takes that are not the patriarchy as such. A much more individual form. Yes. Yeah, I wrote that. In a paper on active imagination. I think that applies mostly to people when they're beginning to try to let the images of the psyche emerge, and it's hard for them to let it come. When you develop some skill in letting the images come, then you can also use a skilled medium. But it's like a slip of the tongue. Or it's like if you can use a medium in which you don't have all that much control, then so-called errors come through and the psyche begins to express itself autonomously without your doing what you think you want to make it do. That's the reason for that. Okay. Oh yeah, absolutely. This painting has my wound in it. Thank you. Somebody's got a band-aid. That's good. Yeah, and I've experienced it too. I guess my overall feeling about it is that it's there in the psyche, and it's doing something. And what it's doing may be a lot less innocuous than getting blown away emotionally for a while. It may hurt your body. You know, there are a lot of things it can be doing, and maybe it's destroying your life in some way. If you don't find a way to relate to it consciously. Now, sometimes people can't relate to it consciously, so what can I say? Yeah, it can be a really potent experience. The way I did it was not to set out to make stuff start coming out. I was blown away already and started doing that in order to take care of it, you know, to work on it, to do something about it and not just lie there on my bed with these emotions sweeping over me. Usually, giving any... See, an archetype can express itself in emotions or it can express itself in images. And usually, if you give an emotion an image, that helps contain the emotion.